Good morning and welcome back to our seminar. We will have four presentations and one poster session in this morning. And yesterday we were talking about sort of the exceptions in parliamentary life, the strong swords, and the intervention of courts. And today we are coming more to the daily routine of many of us, question and answers, and also the presence of members of government in parliamentary sittings and committee sittings. We will have four presentations, one from Portugal, one from Slovenia, and then we have one from Ireland and Sweden, which will present alternatives to court decisions. Maybe it's also interesting because if I'm right, then today court proceedings in Germany start about the duties of the government to answer parliament. And so Ireland and Sweden will present some alternatives to this approach. And we will now start with Bruno Dias Pinheiro. He's from the Assembleia da Repubblica, from here, and he will talk about the presence of government members in committee and plenary sittings. Please.
Good morning, everyone. Once again, welcome to Lisbon. I hope you are enjoying your stay, and that last night was as fun as it was for me. I will try to multitask speaking and using this at the same time, so please bear with me if something doesn't go that well. My intervention will be about the presence of a government in plenary and committees as a tool for the supervision role or the oversight role of parliaments nowadays. I will try, just to have an idea on the five topics I will try to cover. This seminar is about parliament's legitimacy and the new supervisory instruments. I will try to focus on two topics that I find relevant for this seminar. First of all, about the presence of government at the parliament. I will try to describe it as a standing tool for oversight, something that that our parliament uses intensively. But I will also try to highlight a little bit what the political situation in Portugal or the results of the election. That is something that apparently is drawing a lot of attention throughout Europe, also influences a little bit the way the parliament uses these tools. About the Portuguese political system, just so that you have an idea, we have the main features are that after the revolution and after this new constitution was approved, the system tries to strike a balance between the separation, balance, and independence of powers, especially between the president, who is directly elected for 5 years, the parliament, who is also directly elected, and the government that stems from the parliament. I will not go into the debate whether it is a semi-parliamentary or semi-presidential system. I'm not a lawyer myself, so I will leave that to those who know about it. I will just try to describe what this professor refers to, that the constitution is a design, and that the players on the field interpret that design the way they deem appropriate, and it produces changes in the way the system operates according to those actors. Our current situation and going to the role of the parliament nowadays is based on this results of the elections. We had for 4 years an absolute majority government of a coalition of the EPP, the centre-right and the Christian Democrats. After the election 2015, that coalition actually won the elections, but not with an absolute majority. So the government was sworn in, but in the parliament, the opposition filed a motion to reject the government programme, and it was approved. And then a new government was installed, led by the socialists, who were second in the elections. And they established bilateral agreements with three other political parties, the communists, the left bloc, and the Greens, to support them in parliament but not enter the government. So it's a minority government supported by three bilateral agreements with three different political parties that, within a certain remit, decided to support the parliament. This produced a series of changes in the way the parliament operates and in the way it plays its role within our political system. We are all familiarized with the theories of the decline of parliaments. I will not go too much into that. I will just refer to the fact that in our context, the way it's still too early to assess, but what we are witnessing is that the parliament is somehow reinventing itself and playing a new role within our political system. On the other hand, this might seem normal for some of you, because in many countries, coalition governments or minority governments supporting the parliament are a rule. But in our case, with this constellation, it never happened. We are in the 13th parliamentary term after the constitution in 76. Out of these 13, 8 times the left had the majority in the parliament, but they never, until 2015, succeeded in reaching an agreement like this. So the left was the majority 8 times out of 13, but until 2015, they never managed to gather an agreement. Someone mentioned yesterday, I think it was our German colleague, that this was the dilemma of the left. That dilemma of the left also occurred in Portugal. About the role of the parliament. The parliament, we can always say that it is the main legislative institution. We are also familiarized with this theory of decline of parliaments, referring to the fact that governments legislate more and more and more. Some authors refer to the fact that parliaments should not enter this competition with the government to see who legislates more, but the parliament should focus on other roles that it play, namely the role of the political control of the government. In our case, the parliament nowadays has many, many tools for political oversight, and it is the institution which is more prone to public scrutiny. Everything is broadcast nowadays, not only the plenary, but the majority of committees, working groups, hearings, etc., which places the parliament as the main focus for the attention of the citizens. As I mentioned, the fact that we have an absolute majority, or the fact that we have a minority government, might also influence the way the parliament plays its role. But the tools of political oversight are always there, and our parliament, as usually we say, has a lot of tools for the minority and for the opposition. The way the parliament controls. From an academic perspective, we could say that the control of the government is, or this monitoring function, is one of the most important tools nowadays. But I would like to use a concept that the member of parliament who led the reform of the rules of procedure in 2007 used in his... He made a thesis, a master's thesis about this, and he says that the political control of the government is the parliamentary activity that, via a series of mechanisms, can verify and hold accountable the executive and is likely to produce diverse consequences in the political responsibility of the government. Because you can do opposition just for the sake of being on TV, or you can do opposition just for the sake of changing the way the government is implementing its policy. And the new parliamentary situation in Portugal somehow produces this result, because 10 to 18% of the electorate, meaning the left bloc, the Communist Party and the Greens, were never in a government solution since 76. Nowadays they are, but these three political parties who pay a lot of attention to the parliament. They place the parliament in the center stage of the political system in Portugal. And they dominate, they know very well the tools for oversight, and they find themselves in a unique position. The unique position is that they are not in the government. They support the government through these bilateral agreements, but they can still use the prerogatives for oversight that the rules of procedure and the parliament gives them. And this produces a systemic change which is very unforeseeable. We had some examples recently that the government has its line. They agreed on some things, but those things which were not agreed, these parties are free to oppose the government in any way they deem fit. On the other hand, these are the main tools that in the plenary are often used. There are several debates. I will go through some of them. I'm not a specialist in the plenary myself because I deal with the committees, but my director is here somewhere, so she will reply to questions if you have any. There are several debates. Members of government are almost on a weekly basis in the parliament. We have the debate, firstly, of the government program. We have the possibility to submit motions of confidence or no confidence. We have debates with the prime minister every fortnight. So that means that the prime minister is at least twice a month in the parliament. We have several debates with the ministers on many different topics. This reform that I mentioned of 2007 was a breakthrough, especially because it focused on two main aspects. Firstly, to make the plenary more lively and more appealing, not only to members, but for those who watch it on TV, and there are people who watch it on TV, but also to try to establish a role for the parliamentary committees that is also more focused and dedicated to the legislative process and to hold the governments to account. About the plenary, there are two main ideas that I would like to highlight, regardless of the several debates. Multitasking is not always easy. There are two main ideas that I would like to highlight, regardless of all the debates that I will go through. You will not memorize any of them, but the main idea is that, firstly, the government is often present at plenary. Secondly, the scheduling of the debates is not decided solely by the majority. There are certain sets of rights for the opposition, namely potestative rights, which are decided at the beginning of each legislature according to the votes that political parties had, that gives them the right to force the scheduling of a debate. And on the other hand, they not only schedule the debate, but they have the same speaking time as the biggest party. For instance, a political party that has two members, like the Greens, if they force a protestative debate on any of the kind of debates that I will refer to, they have the same speaking time as the majority party that has 89 members. So this is something that strengthens a lot the opposition and gives to the opposition a real effective right to question the government at plenary. Of course, the debate with the Prime Minister is the most appealing debate, especially because all the news cover this. The TVs are always in this debate. It's a debate that since 2007, when it was established, gained a lot of public attention. So the Prime Minister comes every fortnight to the Parliament. You have two formats. The first format, the Prime Minister addresses the plenary with a 10-minute speech and then is questioned, and the order follows from the majority parliament to the minority parliament, and it rotates afterwards. Or you have a simple debate where the first one in line, the first political party in line, questions the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister has the same time to respond. Mr. Negrão yesterday mentioned this feature that he saw as the most appropriate for the lively debates, which are quick answers, quick questions, quick answers. These debates are meant to be like that. Of course, he also mentioned that it's not always the case because it depends on who interprets, depends on the members who address the Prime Minister. It depends on the Prime Minister, but it's usually a very lively political that people are keen on watching. On the other hand, we also have, in terms of EU affairs, every time there is a European Council, including often informal councils, the Prime Minister comes to the plenary to address the plenary, to brief the plenary on the agenda of the European Council, and after the European Council happens, the State Secretary for European Affairs or the Minister of Foreign Affairs comes to the European Affairs Committee to debrief on the outcome of the Council. So it's also a feature that usually when you compare with other parliaments referring to the way they scrutinize EU affairs, it's also a very, it's something that we usually highlight. On the other debates, I will not go into too much detail. This is in the slides. This will be distributed afterwards, I think. So you can. The article of the rules of procedure is always mentioned in the slides. I will not go into detail on all of them. I would just like to stress again these ideas. Political parties in the parliament have the right to force these debates. So the scheduling is not. It's made by the Conference of Leaders, who gathers all the leaders of the political parties, the Speaker and the government. And the scheduling of debates is decided amongst all of them, but the minorities have a very strong right to impose the debates they deem fit. In some cases, from the morning to the afternoon, which changes the schedule, of course. But if you have an emergency debate or a debate about something that is happening, like a bank that went bankrupt or something like that, which was very common, unfortunately, in the last few years, political groups have the right to force this debate, and they have the same speaking time as the majority parliament. So it gives them a tool that I'm not sure, but maybe you can share that with us, is not common in every parliament. You have emergency debates, thematic debates, as you can see, even parliamentary committees, which is a tool not very used, not very utilized nowadays, but parliamentary committees can also propose thematic debates to happen in the plenary, and these are the potestative rights of the parliamentary groups. It is distributed according to the votes they had at the beginning of each legislature, so that the political groups can know when to use and how to manage these rights that they have throughout the year. About committees. Parliamentary committees, as I said earlier, gained a lot of momentum, I would say, after 2007. Nowadays, committees, and especially because, as I mentioned earlier, we have since 2015, if I'm not December 2015, we have a system called Web TV, which broadcasts up until 8 live feeds at the same time. So in a day like today in the morning or tomorrow in the morning, if you have 8 committees meeting at the same time, you can just go online and choose the committee you want to watch. This produces several effects. First of all, members of parliament are keen on having their 2-minute slot on Facebook, on YouTube, on wherever. So they pay a lot of attention to this new role of the committees. On the other hand, citizens pay a lot of attention as well, because they go and they want to watch if there is a working group on a certain bill, or if a petition is being discussed in a committee. They go there and they watch what they want. And also members of government, which is our focus here, that come very often to the parliaments and to the parliamentary committees, and usually it is broadcast, it's always broadcast, unless there are 14 at the same time, through the web, which changed dramatically in a good way, from my personal perspective, the way the parliament is perceived outside. We have, I would say, two different kinds of debates. Our rules of procedure, since 2007, have this innovation that states that each minister should come to the parliamentary committee to which he or she is responsible at least 4 times each legislative session. It can happen, for instance, that a minister that has a very large portfolio might come 4 times to 3 different committees. So that means 12 times in 1 year to the parliament. It's at the beginning of each legislative session, the committees, together with the government and the Conference of Leaders, decides on which dates they will choose for these hearings. On the other hand, there is also the possibility that political parties in the committees make a request so that the minister is heard, or they also have the same potestative rights to force ministers to come to the to the committees. These are the tables. This article 104, number 4, also says that that the groups can exercise these rights, and there was a debate on whether the Prime Minister was also included in this article to come to the committees. It was then decided, I might go a little bit into that in the debate if you want, it was decided by the Speaker that the Prime Minister is outside this scope and should address only the plenary. Absolute majority versus minority governments. I have, these are the potestative rights that that parliamentary groups have to force members of government to come. When we have, this is the current legislature, when we had an absolute majority, this is what happened. The absolute majority was able to vote down any requests that the committee proposed, that the parliamentary group proposed in the committee to hear a minister. In that case, groups had to use their potestative rights. However, in the current situation, these, especially two political parties, the Communists and the Left Bloc, have this approach towards the Parliament, as I said in the beginning, that, that sees the Parliament as the arena for political debate. So they think that every minister should come to the Parliament, regardless of the majorities. So in this current situation, we moved on from the point where only the potestative rights of committees to hear ministers in committees were exercised, to a situation where, for instance, in the previous legislature, we had, these are the potestative rights exercised by groups in the committees. So you see an average of 6-7 per legislative session. In these two legislative sessions of this legislature, we only had 3. And we have a case study, my colleagues from the Health Committee are here. In the previous legislature, we had an absolute majority, and they had 17 requests by the opposition to hear the government in the committee. All the 17 were voted down. Only the mandatory, meaning those 4 that are in the rules of procedure, and the potestative ones were held. Here, nowadays, no requests for a hearing in the current constellation was rejected. So that means that they are now flooded with hearings. They have hearings of working groups, around 30 per working group. They have the minister coming here because of hospitals, because of financing of the health system, etc. And this means that there was a significant change in the way the parliamentary committees work. The geometry is now very variable. It's unforeseeable. We never know if something is going to be voted through to have a hearing with the minister. So it can happen that on Friday there's a request. It is scheduled to be on the agenda for Tuesday, and on Wednesday the minister is here. For the parliament, this is quite interesting. And for people who work in the parliament, it's an overload of work, and it's also very interesting. Just to give you a figure, and Christoph was also interested in that, in the current legislature, and this is data of yesterday because it's when I collected, we had 293 hearings with members of government, and we had 836 hearings with other entities at committee level. So about 1,000 hearings in total. One thing that also draws attention is the possibility to hear high-ranking civil servants. I might go into that in the debate if you want, but for instance, we have a feature now that the Foreign Affairs Committee has something which is not foreseen in the rules of procedure, but it's the possibility to hear ambassadors before they go to their posts overseas. So there's some sort of American Congress hearing, not with all the spectacle involved and not binding, but the ambassadors come to exchange views with members about their future roles. Something that also, and I think that Fernando will then distribute the replies to the questionnaire about parliamentary committees of inquiry in the Portuguese Parliament. We have, from my personal perspective, a very strong legal regime for the parliamentary committees of inquiry. As Mr. Fernando Grão said yesterday, they actually change a little bit the way the parliament is perceived, because they allow for ex post scrutiny very often of facts that happened, and that only those parliamentary committees are able to establish a certain degree of logics and interconnections between the facts to the public attention. We had, especially about banks, of course, because banks are a very hot topic everywhere. We had seven last legislature about, not all about banks. We had two this parliamentary term about banks. We can also go a little bit into that in the debate. Concluding remarks. I see Christoph looking at me. The Portuguese Parliament is extremely generous towards minority rights, as I mentioned. Not only the possibility to impose debates, the speaking time, and the possibility to hear them in parliamentary committees. Of course, after 10 years of these new rules of procedure, we can also claim that there are so many instruments that not all of them can be used, at least not all of them can be used in an effective way. Parliaments choose the ones they feel are appropriate. At committee level, the requests to hear members of government is increasingly from one week to the other. There is a lot of pressure from the media. For instance, my colleagues from the Committee on Health are here now. The Committee on Health nowadays suffers a lot from this mediatic agenda. If there is an outbreak of a certain disease on Wednesday, on Thursday, the political groups file requests to hear 40 or 50 people in the next couple of weeks. If there is, for instance, a scandal about offshores and money being sent overseas, in the budget committee, immediately the groups file a request to hear the former minister, the current minister, the former state secretary, the current state secretary, the director generals, everyone who is involved, because of course this is on TV. It's a unique chance for them to question the government. A lot of political careers are built sometimes on this kind of questioning of the government. So the mediatic agenda puts a lot of pressure. Finally, I'll finish. Finally, the fact that there's no absolute majority increases the role of the parliament as the center for political debate, and also its leverage vis-à-vis the government, vis-à-vis the president of the republic, for instance, as the main arena to raise public awareness. I will not draw any conclusions because it's still too early. We are still halfway through it, this new experience. I will not go as far as to say that we are now living a semi-parliamentary system. Some of the actors call it a passenger or a parliamentarism de passage, just for a couple of years, and then we'll go back to the old reality. But I will just leave you with one figure. In October 2015, the Eurobarometer gave the parliament a 20% approval rating. In April 2007, this rating is of 36%, which is 4 points above the European average, which is 32%. So the way people are perceiving the parliament change, whether it is because of this new constellation of political forces, whether it is because members of parliament now are more involved and more focused in the parliament, that is still to be proved. But the fact is that our life is a lot different nowadays than it was when we had an absolute majority. So I will leave the rest for the debate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have the feeling that we should make a seminar just about questions or about recent developments in parliaments, because this is so very interesting. So I would suggest that we have about 10 minutes for questions and answers, and then we have the presentation from Slovenia, because we have a bit of time in the morning as the poster session is set for 1 hour, so this should work. So are there any questions or comments? Please, Albania.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm too interested to know more about the standing committee control. So despite the hearing procedure standing committee, do they have any other tool to control the ministry that are responsible in that field?
Can you repeat the question? I didn't understand the first part.
Despite the hearing procedure of the standing committee, that they may control the ministry or that they have in that field of the activity, do they have any other tools that they may control at any time that they may decide? For example, to control documents or to call the ministry to come to the committee.
Well, committees have a lot of possibilities to hold the government to account. Well, firstly, they have the legislative process. So if it goes down, if it is referred back to the committees, political groups can, at committee level, express their views. I'm not abusing the committee on health, but for instance, we have now a bill, a draft bill on tobacco, which was proposed by the government. The government was persuaded that this new bill was very innovative in terms of public health and the way tobacco is controlled. But they don't. This was not part of the coalition agreement or the bilateral agreements. So it is not clear, I think it's not clear still, whether it will be approved or not. So political parties have at committee level also this prerogative. Members have the possibility individually to ask questions to the government directly. Committees can also organize seminars. And usually they organize seminars to put a topic on the agenda. I remember in 2014, if I'm not mistaken, 13-14, the Committee on Budget, which was led by a socialist member of parliament, organized a very interesting conference on public debt. And the government back then was allergic to any debates on public debt. So the committee organized this hearing with a lot of international experts to put the item on the agenda. Committees can also organize visits on site. The Committee on Defense organized a lot of visits on site. The Committee on Constitutional Affairs, I think one of my colleagues also here, organized a lot of visits on site. The Committee on Agriculture, for instance, in some months spends more time visiting the sectors, visiting the agricultures, then spends time here in the parliament, which is very fine from my personal point of view. And these moments with the ministers, especially the ones, the four which are mandatory, and the other ones are the moments where they can use all the information they gathered to question the ministers on a specific topic, on the conduction of the general policy of the government. In some cases, ministers are more able to engage with the committees. In some committees, this is more lively. In some committees, this is more harsh from a political confrontation point of view. And each committee has its own soul, let's put it like that. But they have a lot of instruments that they use on a daily basis to construct their acquis of knowledge to then question the government. And then it goes to the plenary afterwards, if needed.
Just to add something else, please. So in the end of this control that may we call, they preparing a report to the assembly, because you mentioned the commission may visit to the ministry as well.
They can draft a report or not. It's not mandatory that they draft a report. If they visit, for instance, we had a problem some months ago with the military because two or three soldiers died in an exercise. And the Committee on Defense went there in loco to gather the information. And they then drafted an internal report to be discussed amongst the committee and to question the minister, who then came to the committee to discuss that specific topic, and which changes would the minister introduce in that specific branch of the armed forces so that people wouldn't die while exercising. This is one example. In other cases, this conference that I referred to about public debt, the same chairman of the budget committee decided to publish the conference in a book. So it's there. It's an acquis. It's a result of what the parliament did about that, or that committee did about that topic. Of course, none of this is binding unless they use other prerogatives. For instance, they can use the possibility to advocate a certain bill, a certain decree law by the government, and then either reject it or discuss it back in the committee. That's another tool. But this is a very hybrid system, and it's not a mandate system, let's put it like that, so that the government is then tied to a report, but it's a flexible way of exercising control.
There's another question from Katrin, I don't know your name, from Cyprus. And no, first is Katrin from Ireland, and then here from Hungary. Can we just get all the three questions and make them short, and so that we can also hear a colleague from Slovenia?
Hi, thanks. That's a really interesting presentation. We have quite a similar situation, so I'm really interested in one thing in particular. With the kind of overload of the agenda of committees, are there any logistical problems to holding all the different committee meetings that are now being allowed? And could you give me some idea, even on average, how many committee meetings each committee would have a week? We just have a situation where the members actually want to have more meetings and there isn't time to have the meetings. And then very quickly, secondly, we have what a lot of the media are referring to as new politics. And we have a situation that's very similar to yours, where we have a small minority government supported by a supply agreement. But the attitude of the media towards new politics has been incredibly negative. I'm just interested in the new role for Parliament is not seen as a good thing. It's seen as making government weak and indecisive, and it's not really helping the parliamentary reform agenda. So thank you.
Thanks. I have a question only. Could you explain what is the difference between the potestative and the mandatory committee hearing? Thanks.
The answer should be really, really short. One is, you mentioned that in the 2007 rules of procedure, you shortened the length of the debates. We're in the middle of overhauling our rules of procedure, and it's one of the things we want to do. So I just wanted to ask, is there a specific provision in the rules, or is there an agreement between the parties on each debate on how long it will take? The second one is, as to the Web TV broadcast, you sort of answered it already. But I just want to make sure, we're a little bit concerned that if we live broadcast the committee meetings, some of the MPs will, overdo the political differences to show off. Have you noticed this? Because it's been, I think, 2 years you mentioned since this thing started. And the third one is, you mentioned a minority parliament now. We're a presidential system, so we function a little bit differently, but we do have a minority government in a sense now. And we've noticed that there's a spike in members' bills, legislative propositions submitted by members. Does this exist in Portugal? And if it does, has there been a rise in it now that it's a minority government? Thank you.
In short, okay. I will start with the easiest one, potestative versus mandatory. Hungary, right? Hungary. The mandatory are foreseen in the rules of procedure, and it states that each minister should come to its committee at least four times a year. So four times a year they have to come. For instance, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, to give you an example, has to come at least four times a year to the Committee on Foreign Affairs. That's for sure, four times. Besides that, each parliamentary group has a potestative right to force the minister to come to the committee plus the four mandatory ones. So it accumulates. For instance, a parliamentary group might know that there's a very hot topic, for instance, 500,000 Portuguese living in Venezuela. There is 500,000 Portuguese living in Venezuela. So a political, which is now, as you know, in a very strange political situation, one of the political parties might decide, we want to hear the minister about this, to know what is being done at the consulate level so that our citizens are protected. So if the government says, well, we don't want to go because it's too hot on the agenda, the parliamentary group might force the minister to come. They don't have the power to decide on the date. So the minister can procrastinate and postpone as much as he can, but the minister is forced to come, besides the four, okay? Overload of the agenda, we have the same problem. Space is limited. We have now 15 parliamentary committees working. We have two subcommittees and around 35 working groups. And the way we organize our proceedings is that on Monday, parliamentarians are in their districts for political work. On Tuesday, the whole day, and Wednesday morning committees meet, and then on Wednesday afternoon, on Thursday afternoon, and on Friday morning the plenary meets, so committees usually don't meet. On Thursday morning, political groups, and on Friday they go home for weekend, Friday afternoon. So that leaves a slot for committees of Tuesday, usually in the afternoon because they don't want to come early in the morning as well, so in some cases, and Wednesday morning as well. So it leaves, a full day, a day and a half. If all the committees meet at the same time, it is virtually impossible from a logistical point of view. And we have the same problem because we have limited space. We don't have that many committee rooms. And then, again, with the broadcasts, not all the rooms are equipped to broadcast. So I have myself and my colleague João, who's there, that leads the parliamentary channel, complaints of members every week because I was sent to this room that doesn't have cameras, or I'm stuck in a smaller room. We have around... It changes. This week we don't have many meetings because the plenary was changed, because the Pope is coming on Friday to Portugal. So committees will meet next. But usually we have around 30, 40 meetings a week, including working groups. And this is a challenge. We are now addressing that challenge. There is a working group led by Vice President Georges Lacan, who was here yesterday, that will somehow equip the Parliament, or aims at equipping the Parliament with more rooms, with more cameras. But it is still, we navigate on a daily basis. And sometimes decisions have to be taken. And it happened already in the past that we had to suppress one of the committees from having web TV. But of course, there's a board composed of members of parliament that takes the decisions. It's not something that we decide on our own. About the media. In our case, the media was a bit shocked with this political solution. Because it's unforeseen. It was unforeseen, and it never happened. Now they are more used to it, and they find it even a bit funny to see how the parliament will solve problems. We had, for instance, in the last year, two parliamentary committees of inquiry, roughly about the same topic, which was the public bank. The public bank had to be recapitalized. A new administration was chosen. This new administration lasted for 3 or 4 months because there was an issue about the fact that they had to make public their revenues. I will finish, yes. And two parliamentary committees of inquiry were composed about that. And I attended most of them. And with the first parliamentary committee of inquiry about the bank, it was flooded with journalists. They were everywhere. The meeting could not even start because they were all over. For the second one, half of the journalists were there. So it's also a barometer for us to see how hot on the agenda is that topic, or if the topic is no longer something that journalists pay attention. But we have a lot of accredited journalists here in the parliament, and the way they see the parliament now is with more curiosity. At least. Natia, 2007, Times. We have to discipline the way the debates are organized. At the beginning of each legislature, the conference of leaders, so the political groups, the government, and the speaker, they decide on the slots. This is in Portuguese. I know that you're not so proficient in Portuguese, but we have the speaking times decided beforehand. So every time a debate is scheduled, it is mentioned which kind of time slot is allocated to that debate. And if you go to the plenary hall, I think they have a visit to the plenary hall, there are watches everywhere that control the time. So when the time is over, the speaker cuts the floor and that's it. Web TV, same here. They overdo the political differences. If you watch a committee with a broadcast, and if you watch a working group with no TV, my colleagues who have been in the parliament for longer than I am say, oh, we missed those days when cameras were not there. Because it's more technical, it's more to the point. It's not so much of a show-off, but the balance has to be struck somewhere. And if it's for the sake of public visibility and the parliament perceived in a better way, it's for the better. About statistics. In the current parliamentary term, we have less proposals made by the government, and a little bit more, but I don't have the data here. I can ask maybe Fernando to compile something to send it to you. But since the government does not have absolute majority, the government refrains itself from sending the bills to the parliament because they don't know, as in the tobacco example I gave earlier, if it will be passed. And if it is voted and voted down, it's a political defeat. If it is not proposed, they can prolong the debate and then find when the moment is ripe for that. But we will have statistics maybe in 6 months' time that would at least have two parliamentary sessions so that we can assess comparing to what we had before. I think I covered it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this interesting discussion. Now I suggest that we go to the contribution from Slovenia and that we postpone the break until 10:45 so that we will have time to discuss. And then we have 45 minutes for the post session and the break. So, Zoran Skubic, who is from the Slovenian National Assembly, will now speak about questions and answers. And as he has worked for a ministry until recently, he will also provide us with the perspective of a government official who has to write the replies to parliamentary questions.
Thank you. Hello. Okay, great. I'll be a little bit more mobile because it's in the morning and yesterday was interesting. Just have to say, when I was writing this presentation, I had influenza, so I don't know what I wrote, but I think it's great because it was from the official translation of the rules of procedure. So I actually don't have a written presentation, that's why I have to walk a lot, because I have to read what I wrote. I'll first have to thank Bruno, because now I have 5 minutes, which is great. Whatever you do in 5 minutes, it's never boring. It's just a joke. I'll just start with this. The first thing is the question time, in my view, is an obscure, but oftentimes obvious, but oftentimes obscure weapon of parliamentary democracy. Because, well, if you check out our webpage, you will find that lines and lines of questions and answers, and there is no kind of order to it. But it's very important for the citizen to know, to ask his parliamentarian what he can do for his case, because not every citizen is a lawyer, and also we lawyers don't know everything. So sometimes you have to have a competent answer from a responsible ministry, and sometimes if you just ask the ministry, they always say, we don't understand, then you have to go there and there and there. But when they're a parliamentarian asks the question, you have to answer, because then you have a problem with the session. If you're a minister and you don't answer questions, you want to pass a bill, you'll have a long session. You have a problem, you have an interpellation. So it's more or less a political pressure. So this is one of the quotes from the government. Stieg Larsson said it, dear government, I'm trying to have a serious talk with you, but if I ever find anyone to talk to, well, pose a question to the parliamentarian. Well, there are two ways of asking the question, either from a parliamentarian, either written or oral. What's the difference? Well, you have 30 days to reply if you're on the government side, or you have to do it over the weekend. That's not the fun stuff. Because a written answer is posed by the parliamentarian in written form, then it's sent to the government, and then the government has 30 days to reply. This is great, but there can be a problem, and now I'm talking from my former position at the ministry. What about if a topic concerns more ministries? Or is it posed to the president of the government, prime minister? Well, then we have a problem. Because if you have to get a competent answer, if it's just for one ministry, it's no problem. 30 days, you do it, then you write it as a civil servant. And then the cabinet checks it, and then it's sent in a written form to the parliament. There's no discussion about that. But when it's posed to the president of the government, then the government sends it to the competent ministry, and you don't have 30 days, you have 14 days. And then there's another complication. What about if two ministers are competent for the answer? Then you have government that decides which ministry is the leading ministry that will compose the answer. And that ministry then sends to the other ministry, and then we have 7 days to answer, which is not a very nice time to be a very competent, to provide a very competent answer. So this is this one. But so it can be very interesting. And also you have to know that these questions, the answers, can also be material for other actions of the parliament against the government or for the government. Also, I know that some of the answers were also in the materials for the establishment of a PCI. So you just have to know what you're answering. The other thing that is very interesting is the oral questions, which are like you have to pose it. I think the term is you have to pose it until noon at the day before the start of the session of the parliament, which, if you know, the session goes for 1 week, and which means that you actually, and the parliamentary questions are usually answered at the beginning, so on Monday, so you have to, so you can pose the question until noon on a Sunday, which is a problem for if you're on the ministerial side, because then you will have to be over the weekend and just stay at your office and wait. But there is a gentleman's agreement that you still have to be at your post until 6 o'clock in the evening on a Friday before the session. But then you have to have, when you get the question, you have to compose the question as quickly as possible so that over the weekend the cabinet or the minister will kind of check it, and on Monday afternoon the minister will have an oral presentation on the topic. So why did I give this one here? Well, this is my experiences. A parliamentary question or a motion must be short, concise, always a problem, and formulated in such a manner that its meaning is clear. Yes, that's the norm. Practice is sometimes you can get 7 pages of a question where you ask yourself after reading it 10 times, and that has happened to me, what is the question? Yes, I had that problem. Because it was more or less thinking about the society as a whole, and then something about brown bears. I'm not making this up. This really happened. I was posed by a parliamentarian who is now not a parliamentarian anymore, even more. He's somewhere in a safe place. No, really, he's in jail. But not for things he did in the parliament and not for the questions he asked. He was a very interesting personality. His name, it's a matter of public record. His name was Lucky Friend, if you translate into English. He wasn't so lucky at the end. But, you know, this is like, well, you know, we are the rules, so we also have the parliament. We also have a commentary on everything we have to do when the rules of procedure are not very exact. So in this case, we as the servants of the parliament are obliged to send back to the parliamentarian a request that you should get this question in order. So you have to, it has to be short, concise, and formulated in a manner that is meaningful and clear. But when you have 50 questions on a Friday at 6 o'clock in the evening, it's not always done so strictly. So then we have the problem at the ministerial level, how to answer the such questions. I'll go just you will read it, of course, because it's published on the seminary site. How does it work? As I discussed, the written questions are sent to the answers are sent to the parliamentarian who filed the question, and then we hope it's he's okay with the answer. He can also pose another question. It's no problem. That's the cornerstone of democracy. But on the oral questions, it's usually so that we have a special provision because there is no discussion on the written answers. The oral answers can be subject to scrutiny because if the... I'm again on the written ones. There is a mandatory timeline, so you only can post two oral questions each session by deputy. But, and that's also the time limit, no later Sunday at 12 o'clock. But there can also be when the competent minister or prime minister answers, you can also say, you can, as a deputy who posed the oral question, say, well, I'm not happy with the answer, please supplement this answer now in situ, or afterwards, and then it's posed like a written question. So we have 30 or 15 days to reply as a competent minister or prime minister. So, and we have this special provision when there is a question time where there have to be answers done orally at the beginning of a session, that the first four questions are asked and have to be answered. So asked by the opposition deputies and then a deputy of the governing coalition. And then it's two questions, so opposition, coalition. Why is, and also the first three questions have to be answered by the prime minister. So why so complicated? Well, because until 2008 we had a coalition that was usually led by one party, which is no longer in existence. It's a left party, so it kind of split it and then faded away into history. So the opposition was always a little bit angry because they didn't win the election, and the second because they felt restricted by the rules of procedure. So they drafted this provision so that the opposition has much more to say than it usually would have to. So, yes. And usually the first questions are answered by the prime minister, then the competent minister, and it's like three questions by the opposition, one question by the coalition, then two questions, opposition, coalition. That's why we also say at the parliament, in the civil servants, the question time, which usually starts at 12 o'clock in the Monday, so first day of the session, lunchtime, because we have free time. So this is, I guess, a little bit, you know, I won't go into details because I'll bore you. All I have to say, when I read all the answers, some of the that were posed to the ministers and the prime ministers, they are very, very topical. And they usually are connected with a case that just happened recently. That's usually the reason for an oral question. And even if the ministers hate it, and also the prime minister I know sometimes hates it, these questions are very important for a citizen who does not know what to do and doesn't know who to ask. And that's why it's important for question time to exist. However, it's a lot of work on both sides, also on the parliamentary and the government side. But that's the reason for civil service to exist. So yes, it has a reason. I think this is the end. I hope I was coherent. But yesterday was interesting. I had a very great time. Hope you did too. And if you have any questions, I'm here to see and try to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have now about 10 minutes for discussion or for your comments. I'm sure that some of you will face similar problems or experiences. So please, from Turkey. Is Turkey right? No.
Halit Tunçkaşık. I have a few small questions, actually. My friend talked about the parliamentary question or motion, he said.
Yes.
couldn't understand the difference mm-hmm. between those two. What's the difference of motion from the mm-hmm. question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the other question is, you said there might be supplementary answers for for questions. Is this is demanded so often or it's not working? And the last one, Secretary, you said the questions goes to the Prime Minister and ministers, that we know, but what about the Secretary General of Government? I don't know who he is.
Okay.
Or she is.
Okay. Thank you. Now she's a she. Yeah, my former boss, she was great. Okay, because she was a parliamentarian before, and she was the president of a committee that I was a legal secretary for. But I don't think that answers your question. Yes, I didn't want to, it's too early, so I didn't want to go to the boring parts. There are two ways of the question time, two ways of, it's either a parliamentary motion or a parliamentary question. The difference is with the title and also with the inhalt, the substance. Because a motion is more or less how a parliamentarian sets out how something should be done or regulated. It's more or less, it's not a question, what do you know, but the question, well, this and this and this, and I do think that this should be done as such. That's a motion. That's a motion, and the government has to answer it. The motion is always written. It cannot be done orally. The government has 30 days to have a more or less a comprehensive answer to this motion in a way that why we are not or why we will or why we are already doing it. That's a motion. Supplementary questions. That's usually, it's interesting. Supplementary can be also written because we are not, it's oral or a written question of a parliamentarian. If it's oral, it's like on the same session, you say the parliamentarian first poses the question directly, and then it's answered by the competent minister or prime minister or a secretary general of the government, because secretary general of the government is usually present when the competent minister or the prime minister cannot attend because he or she has some important business in Brussels, for example. But he has to have a written apology. We are not, I'm sorry, I cannot come to this session because I have this and this European Council meeting. So that's the third question. And the supplementary, I hope I won't ramble too much, it's more when the question is posed and then it's answered, the parliamentarian has the right to speak up and say if he or she is likes the answer or wants something added. And then the prime minister or the minister or the secretary general supplements his answer orally. Everything is done orally. On the other hand, you can also say that in written form, that's, the written questions have almost the same principle. But you have to file again written questions. And we, if you're not, as a parliamentarian, if you're not satisfied with the answer, you can say, well, you didn't answer the question, and now I want to see this and this, which can be interesting. I think I can say that we had, when I was in, so there, then there, there is a string of questions on the same topic. We had an interesting situation when I was working at the ministry, because we had a parliamentarian who was asking the same, basically, for one topic, question after question after question after question, a specific, very, very specific topic. Question after question after question after question. And we had to answer after answer after answer after answer. And if you know Slovenian mentality, one part of the Slovenia is a little bit uphill, and we are very stubborn. So when you have the first answer, you have to answer, and then you, what about this? And you say, somebody's playing a trick on me. Then you get more and more and more in form of an answer. I mean, first it was half page, then it was 2 pages of answer, then it was 10 pages of answer, and I think one, the last one was 15 pages of answer. So you kind of, now read it. Now really read it. What happened, the parliamentarian who asked this specific topic question, afterward, when she was not a parliamentarian anymore, we kind of checked on her. She made a PhD out of this topic. So, but it's all legal because it's public record. You can't find it, or you have to be very, very disciplined to find the answers, but it's public knowledge, public record. So, yeah. Sometimes you have supplements, and sometimes you have supplements.
So, Mr. Wahlen from Germany.
Now we are going. Yeah, good morning. My name is Dirk Wahlen. I work in the German parliament, and I'm responsible for the question. Right. So a problem we are facing is an increasing quantity of parliamentary questions, whereas the quality is decreasing very much, a bit like you described as well, I think. And one thing I'm interested in is whether you in Slovenia are also the other colleagues have discussed any instruments to raise quality of parliamentary questions again, to reduce it maybe to the principal function, to make mm-hmm. The strong instrument of the opposition again.
Well, so I can answer that. Well, you almost answered it yourself, because we have the same problem. A little bit far in the past, this year, we found out that usually we had 30 or 35 written questions per month. Then in 2 consecutive months, we had 100, 150, once we had 400. And it was usually posed by one party, the main opposition party, which is like more or less a game of government, do your job, because when it happened in also in the time where the coalition was a little bit cracking under the pressure. So yeah, we have the same problem. The quantity is increasing now. It's a little bit normal because we almost had a crisis meeting. What's happening? And also, I think the collegium of the president of the parliament had this topic at the agenda. There was nothing, that was more or less a signal, please be a little bit more normal with your questions, but you cannot say parliamentarians, you shouldn't pose stupid questions or a lot of stupid questions. So, yeah, we have this problem the same. The quality should be raised, but, you know, how can you raise the quality if you have in front of you people who were directly elected by popular vote, and sometimes they are open to reason and sometimes they're not? So, yes, you could discuss it at the collegium of the president of the parliament, which is then all the heads of the parties, and say, okay, please, let's just do this like normal people. But how can you regulate parliamentarians sometimes? I mean, until the new elections, basically, you can't do nothing. So maybe appeal to their sense of responsibility, but you cannot do it as a civil servant. You have to do it like a president of the parliament. Hopefully I answered the question.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's more a comment than a question.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You said that written questions must be clear and concise and all that.
Should be, yes.
It should be, yes. Yes, theoretically. In our case in Portugal, we approved the guide with rules, and it was approved by MPs in the Conference of Leaders to make these written questions short and concise and follow all the rules. Of course, it doesn't mean that they are, like
no,
you said,
not.
No. But it improved somehow.
Yes.
The way they did it. We have, hundreds of written questions per month, and that's a problem for us. But we created a dematerialized system, so it's totally digital, the system to send the written questions to government, and it solves some of the questions that you raised too. Because, for instance, if the same written question has to do with more than one member of the government, it goes directly to both members, because when the MP chooses the members of the government, and it does it through the application that we have in the website, it goes directly to that member. So we have the time limit of 30 days, but it starts at the same time for both members, and if they don't reply by that 30 days, of course, they don't fulfill that obligation. So we publish in our website the absence of the answers. And of course, that's only a political sanction. It doesn't mean that they answer, but they try to, really. And I think that's an experience that we want to share with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I'll comment back. Yes, we also have a... I'll be short. Okay, thank you. Hello. Yes, we also have an electronic system for delivery to the government. It's no problem. Just one problem, because you still have to draft a supplementary document where you say the president sends you, of the parliament sends you this and this and this. Please answer, and it has to be signed by the president. We don't have an electronic signing yet implemented, because there is a little bit distrust, and you know the parliamentarians say, well, you're the president of the parliament, you have to do it by hand to sign it, and then you have to scan it and then you sign it. Yes, this is one of the and we also have the guides. Yes, the parliamentarians do have the guides. The question is if they read it. Some don't. So it's basically, yes, you have to appeal to their goodwill and their humanity, but sometimes it doesn't work. But so's life. Sometimes reason doesn't prevail. So I think this should be the end of my comment back, and thank you for your experience.
Just to introduce the poster session, the posters that will be presented following the break. We will have a poster from Cyprus, presented by Natia, a poster from the Czech Republic, presented by Martin Kavina, a poster from Portugal, presented by José Manuel Pinto, and a poster from the Russian Federation presented by Igor Barbashin. After the poster session, when we come back from the break, we will have the voting mechanism set, so you will have probably 30 minutes to vote for the poster you consider to have been the best between the two poster sessions. Thank you.
Thank you, and we will meet again here at 11:30. So it always works when you start talking into the microphone. Before we hear the next presentations, we will have the vote on the posters, and Dalila will introduce this.
Just by going on this site, that's go.voxvote.com, and it will ask you for a 5-digit event number, which should be 61323. So this is what you should get when you enter the website. There are still people coming. I'm just going to, for Natia and for Martin, who were presenters of posters, just to let you know that we have the voting open. And if you would like to vote, please go to this website on your mobile phone and enter the 5-digit event number for voting. Did it work? I think we're all set. Did anyone have problems voting? So we will know the results in a bit.
Everyone is ready? Have you all voted? Yes? Then we will carry on with the last part of the seminar. And we have presentations from Ireland and from Sweden. We will continue to discuss questions and answers. And I ask Catherine for her contribution.
Question, instrument of questions, but I'll just give you a brief overview of how the parliamentary system works in Ireland, and also mention that we've been undertaking a lot of parliamentary reform in the last about 5 years, but in particular in the current Dáil, and just by way of example, there have been 600 changes to standing orders in total since the foundation of the state in 1922, and 100 of them have taken place in this present Dáil. So there's a lot of change, and there's a lot of adaptation from the parliamentary service to the changes. So in terms of the system, just very briefly, it's parliamentary democracy. It is not semi-presidential. The Taoiseach, who is the Prime Minister, is elected by the Dáil in an investiture vote. The Dáil, which is the lower chamber, then approves the Taoiseach's selection of cabinet. Cabinet is, under the constitution, is responsible to the Dáil, and it must maintain the confidence of the lower house of the Dáil. Cabinet it also operates collectively, so if there's no confidence in one minister, there's no confidence in the collective cabinet. And then finally, we have a doctrine of ministerial responsibility, which is underpinned by legislation, by a 1924 Act, under which the minister is individually responsible for all policy in his or her department and in the agencies that fall under its aegis. And also the minister, under the Act, is legally responsible for actions taken by his department and by agencies, but the legal responsibility is the responsibility of office rather than the responsibility of the individual. So this is a context for parliamentary questions as a supervisory instrument. This here is the kind of is what political scientists refer to as the chain of delegation and accountability. Parliament delegates a lot of responsibility to the cabinet and needs to supervise cabinet for this delegation of tasks. This is certainly the theory of parliamentary questions. So, as I say, one of the reasons and the main reason for it is to operationalise the constitutional requirement for the cabinet to be responsible to the lower house. There are also, as we're aware, other purposes for parliamentary questions by way which are related, I suppose, to members' representational function. So members are asking questions to not only supervise and control the government, but to embarrass the government. Sometimes don't particularly expect anything to change. It's just a political tool which is used to embarrass the government. There are also another main reason for parliamentary questions is to cultivate a relationship with constituents. And there's been some empirical research done on parliamentary questions in Ireland. There was a fairly extensive empirical research project undertaken, which concluded that about 56% or a little over 56% of parliamentary questions do tend to be focused on a national issue and are, if you like, aimed at being a supervisory tool, and about 44% were more local in nature and being used maybe by members to cultivate popularity with constituents. Obviously there's some crossover, but that was, so at least we can conclude that some members are using parliamentary questions as the supervisory tool as intended. So just to sort of give a little detail about how questions function in the Irish Parliament. I'm after pressing the wrong button. Oh yeah, hang on. Very briefly, this is probably a tiny bit boring, but I'll just detail the various different question times that we have. So every day, on the all sits Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, every day you have leaders' questions, which is when the Prime Minister comes in and answers untabled questions for 32 minutes, which come from leaders of the opposition. These questions have to be about, relate to public affairs. They have to, sorry, relate to topical issues of topical public importance. And as I say, they're untabled. It's a short time. It's 32 minutes, 3 minutes per question, 3 minutes per response. And then there are two supplementary questions. Then you have Taoiseach's questions, where the Prime Minister again answers questions. This is for 45 minutes, and this relates to public affairs connected to his or her department and to matters of administration that fall under it. Again, this is a short, it's a 45-minute period, and questions are tabled in advance. So they're tabled 3 days in advance, so the department has a chance to prepare them. Then this is followed by ministers' questions. This is arranged on a rota basis, so a different minister will come in each day, and there'll be advance warning of which minister is coming in. They are proposed, there's two different types. One are priority questions. These are really the controlled by the groups and parties, who are allowed to nominate a certain number of priority questions each day, which will receive an oral answer. Then there are other oral questions, and these are decided by lottery. So all members have the right to propose two questions each sitting day, and these questions will go into a lottery, and some of them will be selected for hearing. The ones that aren't heard orally are then become written questions. So we have a lot of different type of questions. Just to follow on, this is followed by a topical issues debate, where a member is allowed to table in advance that morning, a topical issue which must relate to the public affairs connected to the department or matters of administration. It's a slightly different format, and only four issues a day are chosen. So then finally we have written questions. And written questions there's three types. Really, they're either oral questions that weren't answered because there wasn't time, or they are deliberately tabled by members as written questions. Actually, two types. So that's a lot of detail, but really what I want to sort of cover is what are the distinguishing features of the parliamentary questions in the Irish Parliament are. First of all, there's no limit on the number of written PQs that a member can submit, and all written PQs must be answered. So, as you can see, this has a huge inflationary effect on the number of PQs. The second distinguishing feature is this lottery for oral questions has the effect of hugely increasing the number of questions submitted as well, because what parties and groups tend to do is they'll get their members to submit lots of questions that are more or less the same in order to increase their chances of coming up top in the lottery. So again, it has the effect of inflating the number of questions, many of which are very similar. The result, as I say, is, I'll just have a graph here of the number of parliamentary questions. There's been a huge increase, which I know is probably similar in many parliaments, in parliamentary questions. This, I don't know how well you can see it, but this is from 1960 until 2015, and the written questions are the green ones. But you can see that with written and oral in 2015, we had over 40,000 parliamentary questions in a year. So that's just to give some idea, you know, what the administration are faced with and the effect of this kind of liberal regime of parliamentary questions. And also a further distinguishing feature is really that quite a lot of floor time is given over to questions. If you look at the weekly schedule, there's 11 hours per week in total with all of those different question times, which is 44% of ordinary plenary time. So just before I look at whether or not it's an effective instrument of oversight, just to clarify that in the rules it says that the Minister shall address each and every request for information within each parliamentary question. It also says that the purpose of a PQ is to elicit information or elucidate matters of fact or policy, and it shouldn't contain argument or personal imputation. So some parliamentary questions are ruled out of order on the basis of not being in line with these two requirements, but it's low. It's about between 2 and 3% are ruled out of order. So looking at how it works in practice, the first thing I'd say is that perhaps not surprisingly, given the volume of questions, there is a particular attitude from departments and ministers to give away as little information as possible, to only answer the specific question that's answered, and to, in fact, they compose answers in which they say, give this away first, and here's the supplementary material, but don't give this away unless the questioner is, you know, clever enough to ask that question. So the attitude is very much as little as possible and only what's asked. And one particular civil servant testified that this was sort of the strategy, if you like, in departments for dealing with parliamentary questions. And it was so much so that there was a tribunal in the 1990s, and the president of the tribunal was on record for saying that if parliamentary questions were answered in the Dáil, in the way in which they had to be answered in the tribunal, that there would have been no necessity for the tribunal. And the response of a senior civil servant was that the right questions hadn't been asked. And what many people say is that you nearly need to know the answer to the question to ask the right question. So this is a problem. It's not unusual to Ireland, I don't think, but it is getting the answer and having the right spirit of cooperation from ministries can be difficult. This is not helped by the second issue here, which is the attitude of some members. As I said, some members use parliamentary questions literally as a political football to embarrass the government or to get as much information as possible about something in related to their constituency, which can be laborious for the department, but which is their right. It's also not helped by the sheer volume of questions. Departments are under so much pressure to answer questions that it makes quality perhaps a challenge. Then there's a huge issue of since the late 1990s and the early 2000s of the extent of delegated governance from departments to agencies, which was referred to as an accountability crisis in Ireland, where there was one particular period in the 2000s where the Minister for Health in particular, regularly the answer to the question was, this is not a matter for me, this is a matter for the Health Service Executive, which is an enormous state agency which was set up to deliver all health services. So this is perhaps one of the biggest issues that reforms have been trying to deal with, this issue of delegated governance and the question of who the agencies are accountable to. Finally, then, I just put in is more of a question is, you know, the extent to which questions are used ex ante or ex post. I think they tend to be used a little more to find out what has happened as opposed to find out what will happen and what the intentions are. And there's a question of whether it might be more effective to use both. So there have been a spate of small reforms, which could have a significant impact since 2011 and again in 2016. And I suppose my question really is, it's very early to find out whether it's addressing the weaknesses, but they certainly are intended to address the weaknesses that I just identified. So the first mechanism was in 2011, standing orders were changed to enable a member to complain to the Speaker of the House about the adequacy of the reply to the question. And if the Speaker agrees that the member is right, the Speaker will write to the Minister requesting clarification or further information. And the Minister must reply to that by the following day with reply in some way, either by saying, I will get more information, or by replying to the question. Then in 2016, there was a sense that was working to a certain extent, but that maybe there needed to be some kind of a sanction. So there's been a new standing order approved, which says that at the end of each session, so at the end of each year, or it could be 6 months session, actually I think it's at the end of 6 month session, the Speaker puts together a report in which he will name the ministers that didn't cooperate with this procedure, and name ministers for whom there are questions outstanding because the members were not happy with the way in which the question was answered. The first of those reports has been actually, unfortunately, been currently put together, and I couldn't get my hands on it because the Cairn Coroner's office wouldn't give it to me. But they said that it's been used to a certain extent, but it's only really, there's a growing awareness amongst members that you can actually use this standing order. So it's early days. One observation I would have about that standing order is that if it becomes popular to use it, it may become difficult to manage because the Speaker's office only has so many people to deal with these kind of complaints and to assess whether or not the complaint is valid. So before, I suppose it is a consideration about the practicality of the reform. Then two more changes. Ooh, I keep doing that. Firstly, this is to deal with the issue of agencies and the issue of ministers not answering fairly important national questions of national policy, which are under the remit of agencies to whom they've delegated responsibility. So firstly, a new type of answer was introduced, which is a referred question. So the minister can say, this is not a matter for me, but he can't stop there. He says, this is not a matter of me, I've referred the question to the agency. The agency then must respond, or the minister, it's the minister's responsibility to make sure that the agency responds within 10 days. And there's also another new initiative which has been driven by an agreement between the Parliament and the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, and which is also was in the Programme for Government, which is to make agencies kind of directly responsible to members as well as to ministers. So there was a protocol issued to all agencies which explains how they should relate to members' questions. And all agencies now have to, this is in process of being implemented, the agencies have to appoint a senior person to be responsible for relations with the Oireachtas, that's the Parliament, also have to answer questions, set up a direct communication tool, which is usually an email address, whereby members of the Oireachtas can directly contact them if they have questions about operational issues. The bodies are then expected to reply with deadlines. There's a three-day rule that you have to reply to acknowledge that you've received it, and in 15 days then for an answer. And if members aren't happy that agency, if members are unhappy with the way agencies are complying with this, then they have recourse to go to the minister and ask the question to the minister. But the minister will say it's an operational matter for the agency. So the hope is that the agencies will comply with this. So experience to date, as I say, unfortunately, if it was this time next year, I would have way more information about whether this is having an effect. There is, you'd hope to think in time, some kind of an anticipatory effect that departments know that in particular questions that are being answered orally in the chamber, that there is this recourse to complain about the adequacy of the answer. And there is also, which I forgot to mention, there is the on-the-spot, a recent reform that the Speaker can on-the-spot say to the Minister, you're not answering the question if the Member asks the Speaker to. So basically, experience to date is that the Speaker has not used that power yet. He is possibly reluctant to sort of rock the boat too much, but there is an awareness that power is there. And the Speaker, we've just changed the way in which the Speaker is elected, which has made him a much more independent figure. So there is a hope that power will help to improve the adequacy of answers. The other reforms, the course for complaint is being used relatively regularly. About three a week we'll go to the Speaker's office and complain about the adequacy of the question. And to date, most ministers have replied and supplied additional information, and members have been happy with that, certainly have said they're happy with that. But I suppose thinking about the reforms, I suppose you wonder, is there a need to increase the bad consequences of the failure to answer? Also, I think if that were happening at all, we need to do something about the volume of questions, because if we want quality, I think perhaps quantity needs to go down. Also, there's no defining what is an adequate answer. There's no very clear definition about what is adequate. There's no law, no oversight law to suggest what is an adequate answer. If you looked at what was an adequate answer in a tribunal, maybe try and work back from that would be one way. And also, I just have thrown in there, you know, if the mechanism, if the complaint mechanism becomes widely used, there will be a need to enhance the resources of the Speaker's office to deal with the complaints. So any, you know, if any other parliaments have been dealing with these issues and have successful ways in which to encourage ministers to answer the question, I'd be delighted to hear them. Thank you.
As our colleague Anders Orenius from Sweden is covering a similar topic, I would suggest that he carries on with his presentation and then we have a question and answer discussion of both contributions afterwards.
Hello everyone, I'm Anders Orenius from the Swedish Parliament. I'm working at the research department. I'm not an expert on constitutional affairs, but I'm trying to do my best to give an overview. I'm here today to talk about parliamentary control, and I will emphasize on both the role of the Committee of the Constitution and also the questions in Parliament, because they're both connected. So, yeah, this is a Swedish Parliament. 6 months of the year, it's quite dark and cold. Actually, today it's snowing. So it's very nice to be here in Lisbon. I'm grateful to come here, and I would like to say thank you to our hosts for having us here. The Swedish Constitution has four fundamental laws: the instrument of government, the act of succession, the Freedom of the Press Act, and the fundamental law on freedom of expression. The most important one is the first one. The act of succession has to do with our monarchy, most of all. And the number three and number four has to do with civil liberties and freedom or expression liberties. In the instrument of government, let's see. Here, where are we? There is a chapter in the instrument of government, namely chapter 13, where it's regulating the Committee of the Constitution, as well as interpellations and questions, and declaration of no confidence. There is also paragraphs about the Parliamentary Ombudsman and the National Audit Office. All of these, as you see, are connected to the parliamentary control and the scrutinizing of the government. Here is another image of how the Riksdag, the Swedish Parliament, examines the government. To the left, you can see the parliamentary examination containing both questions and interpellations. The Committee of the Constitution, Swedish abbreviation KU, and also the declaration of no confidence. It's another instrument that
can be used in the parliament. I will not go into detail into that. And in the middle, you can see the legal examination, which is another branch of the parliamentary control, where the parliamentary ombudsmen are active. And to the right, you can also see an image of the efficiency audit, which is basically taken care of by the National Audit Office, which is actually connected to the Swedish Parliament. The auditors, national auditors, are elected by the Parliament itself. So, but I'm focusing here on the parliamentary examination. Sorry. No problem. The Committee of the Constitution, one of 15 committees in the Swedish Parliament. It was created in 1809 when Sweden's present constitution was drafted, and we picked a king from France, from the ranks of Napoleon. And the committee prepares matters relating to Sweden's fundamental laws and other matters relating to the constitutional issues. That's their main task. According to the constitution, the committee shall examine ministers' performance of their official duties and the handling of government business. That's what it says. And how do they do that? They have 17 members. They are proportionally formed from left to right. All eight parties are represented. The chair of the committee is chosen from the opposition. It's customary in our parliament. They dispose a secretariat consisting of 11 employees, civil servants. Scrutiny control, you might say that's their most important task. They examine the minister's performance of their official duties and the handling of government business. This scrutiny should be constitutional and administrative in character rather than political. Yeah, here we go. And twice a year, the committee presents reports to the Riksdag with observations. They are called the autumn report and the spring report. The autumn report, the scrutiny of this report, the main focus of this report is the scrutiny of the administrative practice of the government. And it's initiated by the committee itself. And they always focus on the handling of the different ministers. But they also could choose other topics. And in the spring report, which is coming now in June, the scrutiny of the ministers' performance raised by the individual members of parliament. So, this is how it looks like. How does the Committee on the Constitution go about to carry out this examination? This image shows you how it could look like in June, maybe 1 month away, or actually right now also in May, when they have these hearings. First of all, the committee has the right to access to all the government documents, even if they contain classified information. To get more information, the committee addresses written questions to the government. After having received the answers, the committee decides if the alleged ministers should be summoned to the committee. The committee usually holds public hearings with the minister and other individuals involved. This is the picture in the slide. These hearings are open to the public and the media and have attracted considerable attention in the past. After this, the scrutiny reports of the committee are submitted to the Riksdag and debated in the chamber. This debate normally lasts a whole day. This is before, at the end of June or mid-June, coming up. In its report, the committee can criticize, but not formally reprimand or dismiss a minister from office. The committee is not a court, but you can get reprimands, but you cannot get fired. The underlying purpose is to give the government cause to consider its work procedures so as to avoid making the same mistakes in the future. And let me say something about the parliamentary question system. We have three types of questions, generally speaking: interpellations, written questions, and oral questions at question time. The interpellations are, we don't have the problem of overflow. We only have about 500 interpellations per year. So it's not as much as in other countries. The written questions and the question, the oral questions. The oral questions are most often it's the questionings are taking place questioning a minister. They usually question four ministers at the time, once a week. And once a month, the prime minister is called to come to the question time. This is actually quite new in the Swedish political system, only since less than 10 years ago. I was trying to rank what are the most common topics in the parliamentary questions. Labour policy, for some reason, is the most important topic, followed by financial issues, infrastructure, legal issues, industry, education, health, and foreign policy. For instance, EU matters are very uncommon topics in the parliamentary questions. There was a poll done trying to survey or trying to monitor why the members of parliament actually do put parliament correct questions to the ministers. And the answers were as following. It's a way for the opposition to get information and to influence the government policies. That was the number one reason. Other reasons were it's considered to be a cost-efficient and accessible instrument to highlight certain topics. It focuses on the responsibilities of the ministers and the government. And it does create a public debate. And also the element of speed comes up. It's considered to be a good thing. And there were also some negative comments saying that the answers are not comprehensive enough. There are no sanctions involved. And there is also criticism towards that a minority of the MPs put the majority of all the questions. Another thing that has been researched is what is the connection between, talking about scrutiny, what is the connection between the parliamentary questions and other types of scrutiny. It's actually very common that the parliamentary questions in the Swedish Riksdag also leads to bills from the MPs. So there is a strong connection here, 50% of the cases. But actually very few questions lead up to scrutiny and hearings in the Committee of the Constitution, as we just saw. And very few evaluations initiated by the parliamentary committees derived from questions in the parliament. So there is a connection between some types of scrutiny, but not all. And how will the questions in the parliament look in the future? This is also has been different political scientists have been trying to draw some lines for the future. Most people argue or agree upon that the questions in the parliament plays an important role, but the institution could be improved. One of the things that is negative is that the ministers take too long to respond to the questions from the MPs. They have 2 weeks to respond, but sometimes it takes longer, much longer. And in addition to that, some people argue that the parliamentary question could become a more highlighted forum for the public and the media, but the party leaders must be more present. It should be more attention by the prominent politicians in the society and in the Riksdag. Another comment is that today is the prime focus on what could be changed when it comes to the government policies. According to the evaluation, some people think that it would be more interesting to shift focus towards what has happened in the past. Okay, this is, I conclude with this image from inside the Swedish Riksdag. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for these interesting discussions. The very sober Scandinavian one and a bit more heated Irish. We have time for questions and answers now, and the floor is all yours. Can you just introduce yourself?
Josep Pint, Portuguese Parliament. This question is for our Swedish colleague. I just noticed in a slide that a parliamentary ombudsman, which I don't know. So can you describe briefly what are the core functions of this parliamentary ombudsman? Thank you very much.
Yes. I just need to prepare my answer just a little bit. Actually, we have a system called anyone who feels that they have received unfair treatment by a public agency can lodge a complaint with a parliamentary ombudsman. It's shortened JO. The office of the parliamentary ombudsman is an authority under the Riksdag, and it is responsible for part of the Riksdag's parliamentary control functions. The parliamentary ombudsman exists to guarantee that the treatment of all individuals by public agencies is in accordance with the law. Fair treatment by public agencies is one of the fundamental rights and freedoms contained by the Constitution. Complaints should concern government agencies, municipal agencies, officials employed at central governments and municipal agencies, other institutions which are entrusted to exercise public authority. So their role is that they give criticism and advice. It's up to the parliamentary ombudsman to decide whether or not to consider incoming reports. It is parliamentary ombudsman if an ombudsman discovers that a public agency or a court has violated a law, the ombudsman may deliver a statement containing criticism and suggest what could have been done instead. And as a whole, the public agencies generally observe the recommendations by the parliamentary ombudsman. It's not a court, but it's a strong recommendation. And I would say that there is, if you don't comply, there is a great element of shaming if you don't comply. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions, comments, Albani?
Thank you. In the Swedish Parliament, how many standing committees there are, and
how many standing committees?
Yes,
I think we have 17.
17.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but in your presentation, you were focused mainly in the Committee on Constitution.
Yeah.
Does this committee has any special role in the Parliament, or they are equal and same in the?
They have, as we talked about, they have a special role when it comes to scrutiny and oversight of both the government agencies and the ministers' affairs. But they also have some everyday role. There is some government agencies that they also oversee some government agencies, and they have some other roles as well. But their main task is the scrutiny task.
The other committee or only this committee?
It's only this committee, yeah. So in this way, they have a very special role. We have, just like in all your parliaments, we have committees for agriculture and for industry and for...
Yeah, but I guess compared to other parliament, the committee are equal in the task that they exercise. So we don't have any special committee to.
Yeah, I would say this is a special committee, and it's also regulated in the constitution because it's a special type of body. But it's organized like a committee, and it's set up the same way with politicians from all the different parties, yeah. And the majority is usually corresponds to the majority in the parliament.
Mr. Wahlen from Germany.
Thank you both for your contribution. Catherine, you addressed the topic of consequences of failure to answer. That's why I just wanted to seize the opportunity to mention that as a coincidence, today and tomorrow, our German Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe is having oral proceedings concerning answers of the government to interpellation which were made in 2010. And that may be an interesting specific, I think, of the German system of parliamentary questions that may not occur in all countries, that asking members of parliaments and asking parliamentary groups have the opportunity and possibility to file a lawsuit to the Federal Constitutional Court in case they think an answer is insufficient or they are dissatisfied with the answer. And as the right to ask is laid down in our constitution, and the right receive a proper answer is granted as a constitutional right for the members and for the groups, they can submit a constitutional case to complain. Yeah. And we are quite, we will receive the outcome in a few weeks, I think, and we are quite curious to see or to read the decision, as it might be a quite fundamental decision concerning the the restrictions or the question right as such, because the court has planned 2 full days for the oral proceedings. That might be that might indicate that they want to say something fundamental concerning the question right, and that's I think one specific in the German question right system. Another specific, which Christoph asked me to mention briefly, is that we as civil servants of the administration of the Bundestag, we check, so to speak, in the name of the speaker, we check the compliance of the submitted questions with the standing rules, the standing orders, and other legal and constitutional provisions before forwarding the questions to the government, which means, for example, if a topic is beyond the responsibility of the federal government, might be in the responsibility of the federal states, or may it concern private enterprises or something, we wouldn't forward it, and we demand that it's fact-based and has quotations if some statements are made, and often we wouldn't accept if it's only the form of a question, but the content is rather a political statement or something, then we would say it's not part of the question right. Or if private rights of persons or companies are infringed, or infringements of classified contents, maybe that are examples in which we would call the asking group or members of parliament and bargaining changes in their submitted questions. And if we can't reach an agreement, we would deny forwarding the question to the government in the name of the speaker. So this is maybe interesting, specific in the German system. Yeah. It's rather a remark than a question, I think.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Another question.
Where is what is an adequate reply? Where is that defined?
Indeed, it's up to the court to define in every specific case if if the reply is adequate or not. So there are informal ways. The groups would often complain to the speaker, but he has no real remedies or instruments to enforce another reply, and he's also not the judge between the government and the asking group or member. So, to be honest, they complain very often and try to receive another or better reply. But if the government refuses it, they have no other way than going to the Constitutional Court. Okay. But it's of course an instrument which lasts many years to receive a decision.
Thanks.
Are there any other questions? Make one question from Turkey, one from Bosnia and Herzegovina, and then
French. I have a question for Anders Orenius. This committee on the constitution, you said, is composed of 17 members, and it covers all the government, all the activity of the government. Does that not pose the problem of are members specialized enough, the 17 members, to cover all the activity?
Maybe now. They are, to some extent, specialists, but they also receive a lot of help from the parliament as a whole and from other committees sometimes. And I would say that the whole parliament works for the committee of the constitution sometimes with supplying information, making small investigations, background information. Even us at the research department help out sometimes. So they're not experts in all the fields, but they are facilitators or monitoring this process.
Can you hear me? Ah, okay. I would also like to pose a question to our Swedish colleague. You mentioned that questions can turn into private members' bills, right? And you mentioned that it can reach to the number of at least 50% of cases, and it sounded too much to me, actually. But is it an automatic process that if a question, for example, if it is not answered, does it turn to a bill automatically? I mean, is it a legal process, or is it at the discretion of the members that posed the question?
No, there is. This is not an automatic process. For instance, if you are an MP very engaged in the reconstruction of a road, for instance, in northern Sweden, maybe you start by you could see it as a campaign. You start by asking questions to the responsible minister. Why isn't anything happening? And regardless of if you're happy with the answer or not, in many cases they continue with writing individual bills. We have many bills in the Swedish Parliament, more than 3,000 every year, and they are you're not. We have a system where you write your bills during a special time of the year. So around September, October, there is a deadline for all the individual bills. We also have party bills, but more than 3,000 every year. It's not an automatic process.
I have a last question from Bosnia. Does it concern the Swedish system in general, or is it on the topic of question and answers? Because if it's more on the Swedish system, then you can talk it over lunch. Okay. Then I have the last question from Bosnia.
I just wanted to clarify the issue of ombudsman not have any dilemmas. Is he or she a member of parliament, a civil servant, or appointed by parliament for a certain term in office? And secondly, you say that he or she issues a statement on what should have been done. I was just wondering if there is any legal obligation to correct the action of the agency or a public authority that made something which was wrongful. And if there are any sanctions, for instance, in cases where you see repetitive mistakes from a certain office, is there a way to correct or to sanction such behavior? Thank you.
I'm advised to give you a very short answer. No, they're not members of the parliament. Yes, they are civil servants. Yes, they're appointed by the parliament. No, there is no obligation to comply with their decision or their verdict, but in 99% of the cases, they do.
Thank you very much, and I don't want to seem to be too strict, but I know that whenever someone presents something here, questions arise because we are not so familiar with every system, or we hear something that is interesting, but I do ask to consider it that we cannot sort of clarify here any questions, but you will have the chance to talk with each other over lunch or to exchange email addresses, and I know that people are very helpful in the ECBRD network. And also what regards the ombudspersons, as this is a question, there are several requests on the ECPRD, in the ECPRD database, and you get a very good overview over the system in many countries. And I think that all of you that come from parliaments should have access to the website. And if you don't have, just go to your correspondent in the parliament and he will give you a username and a password so that you can read the documentation of the seminars, as well as the surveys and the requests and answers. And this is a very valuable resource. And also, it's you can search it by certain topics, and you can also make a full text search, so it's easily accessible. And there is, like, for instance, in the system of the ombudsman, there is in the ombudspersons, it's an entry, and then you can access a number of surveys in this regard. So, and now, before we come to the conclusion of the seminar, we come to the results of the poster vote. Thank you all once again for participating in the poster sessions, for preparing the posters, for discussing them, for taking part in the vote. And now Dalila will tell us the result.
So, without much suspense, but I can tell you that the vote was very tight. the winner of these poster sessions in the Lisbon seminar is the Russian Federation. Congratulations, Igor Barbashev. You can come to receive your prize.
Dear friends, thank you for your voice. It's a great victory and a victory day. Thank you.
Of course, given the quality of the posters, we have sweet memories for all of the poster presenters, and which we will give afterwards. So, dear colleagues, thank you so much for coming to Lisbon. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we have enjoyed receiving you here. It has been a pleasure to have you here and to have contributed to such fruitful discussions in the teams or in debate. As always, we will all return to our working positions more rich, more knowledgeable of the issues, and also enriched with new friendships. Happy to have seen old friends and to have built new collaborations for the future. Me and Fernando in particular, we would like to thank, in first and foremost, the Secretary General and his office for having embraced the project and supported it all through from the beginning. He understood from the beginning the importance of holding a seminar in Lisbon. It has been quite a long time since we have held a seminar like this one in Lisbon. And so it was very important for us to have the chance to do it again. We would also like to thank Claudia Ribeiro and her team for the knowledgeable and very important support from the beginning in the building of the questionnaire and answering it,
and for answering all the questions we had relating to the topics, and for supporting, of course. All of our colleagues in the Parliament were very supportive, so we must also thank the Publications Division, who helped us with printing the posters and all the materials, and the IT team, Ricardo Vitoria, who was here with all the time with us, and the media support team also, who helped us with the PowerPoint presentations with the sounds. Last and not least, I would like to thank the protocol colleagues, the three little angels who helped us all through the program and make us feel comfortable and in a familiar environment. We have started this project with Andre almost a year ago, and we have continued with Ulrich and with Christoph. And it was hard, but very easy also to to work, because when we work with friends, everything gets easier. I would also like to thank, just to end, all of the people who contributed to this seminar, because we got many contributions during the night and during the weekend, which means that we are all very busy, but we all found the time to contribute to the discussion and to produce consistent and very strong presentations and posters. Thank you very much.
So, I won't carry on with thanks, but just thank you all for the invitation and for the great program we had. And I want especially to thank you for taking part in the discussions, because I think this is the most valuable element of those gatherings, that we have the chance to talk with each other, to ask questions, to learn from each other, and to see that others face the same problems or even worse problems than we do, and that there are solutions, or at least we can sustain each other. And I think the 2 days have given us a very good overview of a lot of questions in this regard. We saw a number of different models and approaches, some unconventional, some maybe strange at the first look. And I think that we all can take a lot home. And if you found some presentation particularly interesting, you should take the chance and approach the presenters as long as they are here, because we have already booked Bruno for Austria, and he will make his presentation via Skype for colleagues in our parliament. I got this idea from the Portuguese parliament, and I think it's a good one to share, because very often it's only one or two persons that can attend from a parliament. It's very different with the Bosnians this time, but I don't know, 6 or 7. but a lot of people, it's difficult. It's difficult because of time, because of money. So this is a very good chance that we can take, that people from the ECBRD network make their presentation, or even a longer one, via Skype, and you can have individual questions. And I think it's a good approach, and we will certainly follow the Portuguese model. This brings me to another topic. Some people ask me how often we do make such seminars. So usually it's once per year, because as you see, it needs a long time for preparation. It needs the willingness of a parliament, and of course people have to travel and so on and so on. So we have been discussing about doing sort of short seminars on the web. There's even a name for this now, called webinar. And Peter Kabur, that you saw him yesterday on the screen, and I have been discussing whether we should do something in the context of ECBRD. There are some topics that often just it's just a small number of people that's interested, or maybe it's a very current topic. We were thinking about data protection, because there was recently a question about the Danish, where a lot of parliaments said, oh, well, we will do this sometime next year, but next year everything should be done regarding the new rules on data protection. So this could be an idea, and if someone of you is somebody of you is interested in joining such an initiative, I'd be happy to receive an email and we'll try to organize something. We've already have a parliament that will be hosting a seminar next year. It will be the German Bundestag and the seminar will be in Berlin. The date is not yet fixed because there are upcoming elections in Germany and they don't have a parliamentary calendar for 2018 yet, but it will be fixed as soon as possible and hopefully in December or January. And if you do have any ideas or suggestions for seminars, don't hesitate and write them to me. I already took a list yesterday and today, and I thought we could talk about minority governments or agencies or even ombudspersons. So there's a lot that came up. And if you do have any ideas, don't hesitate and write. Also, you will receive an email with a link to the documentation of this seminar, which will be on the ECBRD's website. And if you're interested, you can get further information in our area of interest. We will take you to our email list. But if you have colleagues that are interested, just tell your correspondent in your parliament, and we can put them on the list as well. So that's about it. And I think it's now to Dalila to tell us what's happening next.
Now we are going for lunch, and we are having, because the parliament has adjourned the session, a parliamentary session, plenary session for this afternoon, we will have somewhat of a different guided tour. So first we will have a smaller guided tour, and next I think it's all interesting for us all as parliamentary workers, we will be able to assist to a little bit of the plenary session as it's working. Afterwards, the ones who can join us, we will go to Belém to visit the Jerónimos Monastery and, weather permit, to see something around. So thank you very much once again, and I hope to see you in lunch, or if not, I hope to see you again very soon. Thank you.